All right, welcome to this week's Talk of the Rock. I'm your host, Jared Griffin. And this week we're talking about bears, all things bears. We're going to cover every single thing about bears in 27 minutes. No, we are not. I'm joined here in the studio with Joy Erlenbach, a bear biologist with the Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge, and Nate Sabota, area wildlife biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Welcome, Joy and Nate.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
And if you have any questions for our biologists here today, you can give us a call at 486-3181. I think someone will get your question to us here in the studio. Let's go ahead and, I guess, start talking about, we don't have to go into details about the news this weekend with the bear encounter. And Nate, we were talking about this earlier. What is the right kind of language to talk about when we talk about this kind of attack? We've seen the words like attack, aggressive, mauling. I think that's the term they used when a gentleman from Hope last week was killed. So I wonder if we could talk about that for a second. I want to make sure we get that language right when we talk about these things.
Sure. Yeah, I appreciate that. That's a big issue for us as biologists, using the correct terminology. I think a lot of people sometimes use terminology that we're not exactly comfortable with regard to bears, particularly terms like aggressive. You know, I'm sure people have their own definitions of what an aggressive bear is versus a non-aggressive bear. And I could certainly see where a situation that happened this weekend, somebody might consider that bear to be aggressive, when a lot of us in the biological world might not necessarily see that in the same light. For instance, talking about the incident that happened this weekend, there was quite a few people who were saying, oh, this is an aggressive bear, this is an aggressive bear. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, I don't know if that's a fair characterization. You know, although the bear did clearly maul somebody and that people might look at that as being aggressive, you know, more than likely that was probably a defensive attack versus a predatory attack. And what I mean by that is the bear was more than likely defending something it considered a threat, you know, whether it be a threat to the cubs or whether it be a threat to a food source or to that particular bear. Typically, those type of incidents are what we refer to as defensive attacks. Mm. And of course, the bear can come across as being aggressive because it is going after somebody. But I don't know if that's really a fair characterization. To me, that kind of leads people to believe that this bear is out there searching for people or searching for some sort of human prey item, when I don't think that's the case at all. And what we've found in most bear attacks, particularly brown bear attacks, is very rarely is that the case. Mm-hmm. Almost always, the reasoning for the attack is usually defensive. So I think you bring up a good point about using correct terminology when we're talking, particularly to the public, about that, because we don't want to give people any false impressions on any bear behavior, how the bear might be reacting to a certain situation.
Mm-hmm. Joy, do you have anything to add on your side? How do you and your colleagues talk about when these encounters get violent?
Yeah, much in the same way that Nate mentioned. I think it's really important to talk about the language we use and how complex these situations are and how we often don't know what was going on in the bushes that we weren't able to see when something like this happens. And so just being careful to not assume that it was an aggressive situation to start with. I agree.
Okay. So what have you found to be some of the best safety precautions? There's been a lot of talk about the bear spray and how that helped Mr. Zimmerman. How do you feel about bear spray, and what are some of the other precautions that you take when you're out in the field?
Yeah, I agree completely that bear spray is really important. And within the bear world, all of my colleagues carry bear spray. It's something we rely on as part of our job. It's something we encourage everyone to use. And one of the things I've found that helps me is I don't often wear a belt. I don't like them. I'm often wearing athletic clothes where you wouldn't be wearing a belt. And so something that's worked well for me is to find a specific bear spray belt where it carries the bear spray in the small of your back, and you can just leave your bear spray in that belt all the time. It's made by a company called Scat. And these belts, you can just hang by your door, and pretty soon it becomes really normal when you leave your house to just throw that belt on over the top of whatever you're wearing. And that way you can make sure that you always have bear spray with you. There's no chance that you're going to leave it behind. And I think that definitely saves lives.
What is it in the bear spray? And this does like no lasting harm to the bear, correct?
Right. It's similar to what, say, law enforcement uses in their mace that they use. You know, it's capsaicin is the active ingredient that causes irritation to the eyes, nose, throat, wherever it's inhaled or exposed to. And you're correct. At least to my knowledge, it doesn't cost any doesn't lead to any long-term impacts, negative impacts.
All right. So let's talk about some of the work that you do. What are we trying to learn about bears right now?
I'm sorry, I just want to interject one thing real
absolutely.
Quick about bear safety that
we were talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. So I completely 100% agree with Joy about the importance of using bear spray and carrying it with you at all times. As she pointed out, individuals in our profession carry it all the time when we go in the field. Mm-hmm. A lot of people rely on it more so than they do a firearm, just because one, it's a little safer, it's easier to control. But two, I think it's important to remember that although these tools that we have are really useful and very beneficial, you know, the best tool that each one of us have with regard to bears is your mind. You know, you need to be really cautious, obviously, when you go out in the woods, but there's certain things that you need to be thinking about and keep on the top of your mind at all times. You know, in addition to carrying bear spray and other defense, if you will, mechanisms, you know, your mind is by far your strongest advocate when it comes to dealing with bears. And so people need to be thinking constantly about the trail that they're on, what's up ahead of them, are they making noise, you know, put themselves in a situation that if you're running down a trail, people should be thinking about this. If you're going down a trail, whether you be running or walking, whether you're alone or with companions, be thinking about, okay, well, what are we going to do if we become approached by a bear, you know, or what is ahead of us that might be bear territory? Or are we along a stream bed where there's lots of salmon, you know, just be thinking about these things all the time. And that I think is going to be your strongest, defense about with regard to having a negative conflict with a bear.
Yeah, I agree. So much of what we do working with bears and living in bear country is prevention. That's really the number one tool that we use. And then you have a backup plan in case that prevention doesn't work. There's always a backup plan.
And that backup plan no longer includes playing dead, right? Or fighting back. This is the make yourself as big as you can, slow, talk to the bear, back away. Is that?
Yeah. And, you know, at least what I'm referring to right now is brown bears, right? Black bears are a whole different deal.
Interesting.
If we want to address that, we can address that. But I'm more interested in talking about black or brown bears right now, because that's what we have here on Kodiak. And so, yeah, you're right. You know, make noise, make yourself look big, et cetera. You know, most people know those steps. However, if you are attacked by a brown bear, you should by all means play dead. Hmm. You know, usually, as I was pointing out before, most of these brown bear attacks are defensive attacks. So there's a threat that the bear is trying to neutralize. Hmm. And as long as you're on the ground moving or screaming out or whatever it may be, making noise, that bear could very well think that that threat has not been neutralized. And that could quite possibly be what happened this weekend. The gentleman was attacked, he was mauled, he was on the ground. The bear perhaps thought the threat was neutralized, it walked off. And for some reason, the bear came back. And we don't know what that reasoning might be. Perhaps the individual started moving again or whatever, and the bear came back. And luckily for the individual, he had bear spray and was able to deploy it successfully. But playing dead is very important. You want that bear to think that this threat is neutralized, and it'll most often go on its way.
That's good to know, because you hear all sorts of things. The playing dead thing doesn't really work anymore, but
I wouldn't do that with the black bear.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah,
we don't have to talk about.
There are different strategies if it's a curious bear versus a defensive. So it does get complex.
Sure.
Nate's exactly right. Playing dead in a defensive attack is still the thing to do.
And this kind of gets to what you're just saying. The bear might be curious. The bear might be defensive. We think of brown bears as brown bears, but they have unique characteristics, unique personalities. Is that how we understand at least the Kodiak brown bear?
I think that people that spend a lot of time around animals in general notice that most animals have what we would call a personality. And so it's not crazy to think bears do also.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so back to these beautiful, magnificent creatures that we call the Kodiak brown bears. We've had a couple of people interested in what is the current research right now. What are some of the new things that we are learning about bears, their diets, their behavior? What are some of the things that you two are focused on right now when you're out in the field?
Well, we have a couple projects, Alaska Department of Fish and Game, along with a number of our Native Corporation partners, have a couple projects underway right now. One on a fog neck and Raspberry Islands, where we're looking at movements and particularly how bears have responded to the ongoing logging that's been taking place on a fog neck. It's kind of a multi-species project where we're looking at the impacts of logging, both positive and negative impacts on both elk and bears, and how that might impact their movements and their seasonal shifts in diet, and how that kind of ties in. We also have another project in cooperation with Old Harbor Native Corporation down on the island of Sikelitik. That's kind of a long, ongoing study. My predecessor, Dr. Van Dale, started that in the 90s, or I think it was in the late 90s, perhaps. And that's been going on since. And in that project, we're looking at reproductive rates, so how many cubs are sows having each year, and then what's the survival rate of those cubs up until they are weaned and are on their own. So the other thing we're looking at is birth intervals. So how often do sows have cubs? And then how many cubs are they having? And then what's the survival rate of those cubs? So those are a couple of the projects that we have going on.
And do we know? Do you have some data already about those things, especially like the reproductive rate and the survival rate of cubs?
Yeah. So what we've seen on Sikelitik is we do have pretty high reproductive rate. We have each sow has about 2.7 cubs per birth, and so obviously some cubs are having, or some sows are having more, some are having less. But that's a pretty high rate. But one of the really interesting things that we're finding out is, at least on Sikelitik Island, they have relatively high survival rates. So we've had about 79% survival for cubs of the year up until they're 1 year old. And then 1 year olds have about a 97% survival. And then after that, what we've seen is 100% survival for cubs two years old until they're weaned.
Oh, okay. So I was just about to ask, when you talk about survival rate, it's up until rate up until they're weaned, and then after that is...
Exactly. Okay. So we can keep track of them when they're with the sow, when they're dependent young, because we have the sows radio collared. When they get weaned and they're on their own, unless we were to go and deploy a radio collar, we really have no idea how to identify individuals. So it's kind of the nature of the work.
All right. And over over at the refuge.
Yeah, yeah. So I just got here in March and started my position pretty recently. Mm-hmm. So I'm in a phase of trying to figure out what the needs are and where my research heads in the future. But in the past, before I got here, there was some pretty extensive work done on diet and habitat selection of bears within the refuge. So focusing on salmon and berries and how bears use salmon and berries as the climate is changing. So there's been some really great work done, and those are still issues that we'll probably keep investigating. But for now, like I said, just trying to get a handle on what we need to be looking
okay.
at.
Okay. We did have a... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I was just going to mention, our two agencies have a great working relationship, and we do have a couple other, I wouldn't say they're necessarily research projects, they're more survey and inventory type stuff. Mm-hmm. Where, for example, we have what we call the IAS, our Intensive Aerial Survey, that we conduct every year with the two departments. This year, although due to the COVID stuff, we weren't able to implement that survey this year. But we do have a joint survey where we go out in a particular area of the island every year and do a intensive aerial survey to try to get a bear population estimate for that particular area. So that also has been ongoing for many decades.
Okay.
And that's something that we plan to continue for the time being.
I'm going to come back to the aerial inventory survey. Was that the...
Intensive survey. Aerial survey, yeah.
Intensive aerial
survey.
Intense
in the sense that we do it... We run multiple transects with multiple planes over a course of multiple days.
And back to Joy, we had a question come in, and wondering if you could talk about what is the normal food cycle for a Kodiak bear. What do they eat in the spring, early summer? When do they move into the streams? What do they eat before they den up?
Yeah, sure. And Nate, feel free to jump in as you have more experience on Kodiak than I do. But bears actually eat a lot more vegetation than some people realize. And so in a lot of places, and probably Kodiak as well, we see bears coming out of the den in the spring and eating primarily fresh green vegetation that's coming up. And in some places, on an annual basis, bears can eat 50 or 60% vegetation over the year, which is pretty substantial. But here, yeah, they're coming out, they're eating vegetation, maybe winter kill ungulates, things like deer.
So is vegetation like, are we talking to, obviously berries, but grass?
Well, so berries are more available in the fall, so they'd be eating things that are like grass. Yeah, the green leafy stuff. And typically they try and find things that are higher in protein, higher in digestible carbohydrates. And so any of that stuff that's just popping up in the spring is pretty tender and is usually the better vegetation for bears. And so that would be in the spring. And then as we move on to when salmon are available, they'll start eating more salmon. And then they often mix salmon with berries and consume salmon and berries into the fall.
Have we seen we've had some pretty low salmon runs. Have we seen that affect bears' diet or their kind of diet cycle? Ish, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, bears are, opportunistic omnivores, right? So they're going to eat what they can that's nutritious when they can. So if salmon aren't available, they're going to be searching for other food resources. And some of those food resources include, for instance, beach hoppers. You know, if anyone's walked down the beach and kicked over a thing of seaweed, they're going to know there's a whole bunch of little bugs, which we call beach hoppers. I don't know what the name is. I call them beach hoppers.
I finally have a term for those things. Beach hoppers.
Or, other kind of marine-derived nutrients. You know, sometimes there's whales that wash up on shore. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. we've had a big spat of those lately. Clams are another big thing. We've had a couple reports of bears eating seagull eggs. So,
interesting.
So there's quite a big diet breadth of bear food resources.
Nate, you had mentioned that you had suspended some research or the survey because of COVID. How has that affected your ability to research and go out into the field and observe or even collaborate with other scientists who might usually come up in the summer?
Yeah, it's been challenging. You know, the project that we have underway on a fog gnat and on cichlidic actually is one of our other partners is a State University of New York. So we have two PhD students working on the project, and getting them here, especially since New York, as most folks know, has been a real big hotspot for COVID. But getting them here was challenging, to say the least. They had to fill out travel plans, and they had to abide by both the travel and the mandates in New York and in Alaska. And it took, quite honestly, it took a couple months to even just get them here. So it has been challenging, and I know the refuge has faced a few challenges as well.
Yeah, you know, like I said, I started in March.
Right. And, did you get here before everything closed down?
I had about 2 weeks of what I would call semi-normal life, and then I went into COVID thing. It has impacted our work quite a lot. We weren't able to do the intensive aerial survey this year, which I was really looking forward to as my first survey for the job. And then we also have a secondary survey that Nate mentioned that typically happens in July and August, looking at bear compositions on streams. And we also weren't able to do that because, unfortunately, a lot of the work we do is either via boat or small airplane. And the government just hasn't felt comfortable letting us fly or be in restricted spaces with other people. So we've had to put a lot of that work on hold. So I just actually got out into the refuge recently, and it was pretty exciting, about 5 months in.
And you also do research like out in Katmai. You go out there or have gone out there?
Most of my previous work was in Katmai before I started working for the refuge. So, yeah, spent about four or five years working over there.
Also kind of related to that is we have obviously seen a huge decrease in tourists and maybe even, I don't know, it's we don't really have a way to gauge that. We have definitely seen a decrease in tourists, but maybe there's more people going out to do more outdoor things who already kind of live here. Have you noticed any kind of correlation between there are fewer people here and bear activity and bear behavior, or do they kind of just run independent of this influx of people that we get during the summer season?
Yeah, boy,
that's all you. I'm new to the area. I wouldn't know any different.
That's a difficult one to assess. Mm-hmm. But one thing I can comment on a little bit, and we still don't know what exactly the impact's going to be, but due to COVID, you know, as many folks know, we have a spring and a fall bear hunting season on Kodiak, right? And this spring, due to COVID, we had an incredibly reduced season. For instance, no non-residents, which typically make up about 37% of the harvest, were able to come to Kodiak to hunt. And in addition to those non-residents, there was a significant number of residents who were unable to come due to travel restrictions to come on hunt on Kodiak. So typically on Kodiak, we harvest anywhere from maybe 180 to 220 brown bears a year. This year, that's going to be greatly reduced by the lack of hunters and lack of people coming to Kodiak. So that's something that has yet to be determined. You know, we don't know exactly what that's going to do to the population. We don't know if anything, you know. So that's something that hopefully we and our colleagues at the refuge can look at and try to wrap our head around a little bit to see if we can identify any of those changes.
Has the bear population been pretty steady?
Yeah, historically, yeah, that's another thing that is somewhat difficult to ascertain is what is a really robust population estimate. You know, my predecessor, along with the colleagues at the refuge, have made some great strides in getting a good population estimate. You know, those methods are a little bit outdated, you know. So we're trying to figure out how we can get a more robust population estimate. And who knows, you know, it might still be the same as it's been historically, but there's, we'll see.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure, like, once all this is over, the it's going to be really interesting to see how, not just bears, but, you know, all of the wildlife, especially those that have a hunting season dedicated to them, that, yeah, that'll be really interesting to see. We do have, yeah, we have about a couple minutes left. Let's talk about the kind of research that you would like to do, maybe that you haven't started yet, or something that's on the horizon. What is it that we are anticipating researching or learning about bears in the next, oh, I don't know, 5 to 10 years? Kind of looking far.
Sure.
Yeah, Joy, what do you think? You're new here, so what yeah. You're full of optimism and energy.
It's true. Yeah, I am quite frankly still pretty focused on salmon. And the more I read about the salmon populations and how they seem to not be doing that great, mm-hmm. in my opinion, that I think that that's going to be a really big issue for bears who've relied on salmon so strongly for so many years. And so I am certainly not going to abandon researching the influence of salmon on bears.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
One thing I'm hoping to address with our colleagues at the refuge is, as I mentioned before, trying to get kind of an updated, robust population estimate for the island. I think that's one of the big needs that we have right now. And not only getting a population estimate, but then also coming up with some sort of indices, some sort of index that we can look at on an annual basis to try to monitor these fluctuations in population size.
Oh, okay.
You typically getting a population estimate for an area, particularly the size of Kodiak, is pretty resource intensive and usually quite expensive. So we can't afford to do that every year, every couple years. So ideally, it would be great to get a good population estimate and then have some sort of index that can tell us as the population fluctuates based on various variables.
Okay.
Yeah, and similarly, we're looking at different ways of estimating populations as well. And one of the things I've started talking to people about is infrared technology and whether some of these emerging technologies that might allow us to survey more efficiently or to see more bears than maybe we see with our naked eye, if that might be a technology that we could use on Kodiak. So those are certainly conversations that we're having.
That sounds way cool.
It would be cool. It's very expensive.
We will have to have make this like an annual kind of bear update, because I want an update on infrared technology.
Yeah.
and bear counts and things like that. Wow, that sounds great. All right, well, we have about 30 seconds left. So thank you so much to my guests. Nate Sabota from he's a area wildlife biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and Joy Erlenbach, relatively new to Kodiak Island, so welcome, bear biologist with the Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge. Thank you for taking some time out in the middle of your day to talk about bears and correct some myths and talk to us about these magnificent creatures. Thank you for your work out there.
No problem. Yeah. Thanks a bunch.
Thanks for having us.
This has been KMXT's Talk of the Rock, our local community affairs program. Tune in next Tuesday at 12:30 to hear more about local issues and organizations.
You're listening to KMXT Kodiak.
World Cafe is supported by Kodiak Area Native Association's Tobacco Prevention Program. Quit for yourself. Quit for your family. For more information or tools to quit, contact a Canna Tobacco Prevention Specialist at 486-9800.
Think way back to the end of March, right around the time lockdown started, and maybe you were faced with a whole bunch of time at home. So what did you do to keep yourself busy? Did you finally get that home renovation done or try baking bread? Or maybe you took up painting? Or maybe you didn't do anything at first. At the beginning of quarantine, Minneapolis-based singer-songwriter Ondara spent a few weeks of doing nothing. He was in a mental rut. And then one day, he woke up and started writing songs.
I wasn't really planning to make a record. It wasn't meant to be a record. It was just meant to be a sort of therapy to help me through the times. It turned into this isolation album.
That album is called Folk and Roll Volume 1, Tales of Isolation. And if you could maybe use a little therapy yourself, you'll hear Ondara perform songs from that record today. I'm Raina Duras. This is World Cafe. First, pop quiz. What's the right time? Did you say daytime? Nope. Did you say lunchtime? Sorry, wrong. Did you say nighttime?